Hello everyone and welcome to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. I'm your host, Eddie Palmgren, and with me in the studio is my friend and colleague, Niklas Sävås. For this episode, we are excited to have Jamie Lester on the show. Jamie is a hedge fund industry veteran who has worked at firms such as Steinhardt Partners and David Einhorn's Greenlight Capital. Jamie is also an adjunct professor at Columbia Business School, and he has managed his own investment fund for 9 years. So, Niklas, which book will we speak about?
So today we will discuss the book Pause to Think, which is a compilation of 32 mental models. The author also puts these models into various frameworks, such as how to make better decisions and how to become happier.
And what do you think about Jamie's book?
So back in 2016, I got hooked by the concept of mental models, and I started to read the Farnham Street blog, which really kicked off my reading habits. And since then, the concept has a special place in me. And I think the author has done a great job to both compile the models, but maybe more importantly, to make them more actionable. And I really like that he uses comedy strips to drive home the main points.
Pause to Think was published by Columbia Business School Publishing in 2024, and we are delighted to discuss it on the show today. Here comes our conversation with Jamie Lester. Hello, Jamie, and welcome to Investing by the Books podcast.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Where are we reaching you?
I'm in New York City. I'm in chilly New York City.
And to begin, how did your passion for investing start?
You know, I went to college as a chemistry major. I had taken enough classes that I could graduate in 3 years as a chemistry major if I wanted. And then I worked in a chemistry lab the summer after freshman year, and I decided I no longer wanted to be a chemistry major. And, you know, it's one of these lucky happenstances. My father had taught the child of a well-known hedge fund manager and basically arranged for me to meet him, and he gave me a summer internship. And that was the summer of 1995, which was, I think, before a lot of people knew what hedge funds were, or certainly they weren't as widely understood or widely, viewed as an employment option back then. But I just loved it. I loved the, you know, intellectual challenge, the pace, the ability to learn new things every day. And then the next summer I worked in investment bank. I decided I liked the buy side better. And so I kind of stayed there for the rest of my career.
And today we will speak about your book, Pause to Think, with the subtitle Using Mental Models to Learn and Decide. How do you define a mental model?
Yeah, so I define it as any concept or framework that helps you improve your intellectual processes. So that can be thinking, deciding, processing information, learning. And in my book, I kind of just divide it into different concepts and then different frameworks in which those concepts can be inserted. Which we'll discuss later.
And a lot has been written, of course, on mental models, but you mentioned in the book that you saw a gap in the material out there. Can you tell us about this gap and why you decided that there was room for another book on the subject?
Yeah, look, I love books on mental models. I've probably read 100 of them. But I think they're mostly structured as interesting examinations of human fallacies with the implicit idea that if you avoid these mistakes, you'll be better off, which is true. But I don't think it's enough. So I wanted to write a highly prescriptive, actionable guide that assembles these ideas into frameworks that can be applied to everyday life. So it's kind of like an intellectual self-help guide. And that's what I'm hoping this book will be.
And many different people, of course, define mental models maybe a bit differently and think others are more important than other people think, and so on. So how did you decide which mental models to include in the book?
Yeah, I started with a long list, and then I whittled it down, and I wrote the book with, you know, it started with maybe 40, 45 different concepts, and then ended with 32. So, I think the criteria are really, what do I think are the most important, interesting, and most broadly applicable? I mean, I think there are some in there, like inversion or expected value, that are just so valuable to understand. They really should be discussed in every mental models book. And then there are others like perspective, say, which I thought was more important to show, you know, the power of certain ideas to exist in disparate intellectual pursuits. So they're all in there for a reason, but they are, you know, I think it's one of these things where you write the book, you live with the book, and then you edit it, you know, 5 or 10 times, and then what's left is left.
And one of the chapters in the book is about learning, and with all your experience, what lessons from learning about mental models did you use in the way you structured the book?
Yeah, I think that the you know, one of the examples is that there's a comic with every concept, right? And so, you know, I think one of the ideas about learning is that humans are better at learning by hearing things or by seeing things and using those visual or auditory stimuli to form narratives in their brains. And it's much easier to absorb concepts and to remember concepts that way than it is to see little symbols on a page and then translate those. So the idea behind putting the comics in was to address that aspect of the learning framework, you know, which I think is important. And, you know, when I started, I tried to just find cartoons that would illustrate the concepts on the internet. And then what I found was, A, there weren't really great cartoons that did exactly what I wanted them to do, and B, you know, licensing is a huge pain. So, you know, I found this talented illustrator online and wrote all the comics out and had him draw them out for the book. So
it's definitely something that distinguishes this book, I think. We haven't seen it in many of the other books that we read.
Yeah, well, hopefully some people like them. I think other people skip them, and you know, whatever works for people.
No, I think for me, how I think, I think you've hit it right on the head, because it's when I will think about your book in 5 years, I will remember the comic strips and the other things will be sort of in my brain, but I won't realize that it came from your book exactly. If you understand what I mean.
Yeah, that's great.
And going in a bit to the concepts, one of the chapters on mental model concepts is investing in science. I'm curious to know, why did you decide to group investing in science in the same group?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a little bit counterintuitive maybe, but you know, investing is, I think a lot of people would say, a bit of an art and bit of a science, right? And so I do think there is, you know, a lot of overlap, and there are a lot of concepts from science are actually applicable to investing. And the one that comes to mind is checklists, right? So checklists are one of the concepts I have in there. They're a very powerful tool because the human brain is very good at focusing on a few things at once, but not necessarily remembering 100 different, you know, specific actions that need to be taken. And so, you know, checklists are widely used in surgery, for example, right? Where the surgeon will go through a literal checklist, say, okay, have I done this? Have I done that? Have I made sure I'm operating on the right side of the body? Have I removed all the instruments from the body, et cetera, right? So, and once checklists were put in place in surgeries, that, you know, the rate of surgical error dropped dramatically. And same thing for investing. You know, for my investing process, I have a checklist, and the checklist is, hey, check the, you know, the ROIC of the business, check the trend of that ROIC, check the, you know, the ROIC of the competition, you know, and 100 other, you know, different aspects of the investing world. And over the years, I've added to that checklist. And I think it's really important. And so, you know, I think that's just a good concept to show that there is a, you know, there are a lot of elements in the investing world that are kind of this methodical, you know, derived from the scientific method, perhaps. And yeah, there's just a lot of overlap. So I decided to combine them, and also the numbers worked out such that was a kind of a natural pairing. So
And I'm also curious. I mean, you mentioned a few examples of your checklist for when to make an investment. But do you also have a checklist that, I mean, for your sort of cognitive state, if you're stressed and so on? I mean, tell us a bit about your checklist for I mean, in total.
Yeah, I don't. I have more of a checklist. So on the checklist are, you know, more of the fundamental aspects of investing. So it's the business quality, it's the, you know, the multiple you're paying, it's the, you know, the accounting adjustments that need to be made to kind of reconcile the accounting results with the economic reality. There is an element in there of what sort of market regime are we in? Is this the type of investing climate that is hospitable to this type of investment? Is this type of investing climate where the, you know, the marginal dollar, you know, is likely to ignore this stock for whatever reason, right? And so that's more of it. I mean, in terms of my own personal, you know, feelings, I think that, you know, it is very hard to separate emotion from investing, and that there's something very visceral about making or losing money that even after, frankly, you know, 30 years, it still is an issue. So I think it is very important to keep that, keep those emotions in check and make the best decision you can with the information you have. As we'll talk about the decision-making process, you know, you can only control your decision. You can't control the outcome. And so I think that's just important to keep in mind, but yeah, I don't have a specific checklist around it. It's just something I'm constantly aware of, as I think most investors should be.
From reading your book, it's clear that you have a good understanding, at least, of the different cognitive biases. And in the book, you have a chapter on that. And you mentioned a number of them, like overconfidence, framing, stereotyping, and a number of others. And I think many of our listeners, they are familiar with these terms. But you list 39 of the different cognitive biases. And what is interesting is that you group them into three categories. So could you please tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, again, this is one of the maybe the small peeves I have about the mental models literature, which is, you know, there are a lot of psychological studies out there, and they've found a variety of different, you know, call them faulty heuristics or cognitive biases that exist in humans, and they're all really fun to read about, and I think there are tons of, you know, experiments where like, oh, that's really funny that people did that, you know, that people made such a basic math error because they were, you know, peeling through the emotional side of their brain, you know, the idea that there could be more, you know, librarian anarchists than there are total librarians, or, you know, that sort of experiment. But the reality is most people are not going to remember the names of all these biases, and most people shouldn't need to, right? Whether it's loss aversion or certain loss aversion, or, you know, they're kind of the same thing, but they're a little bit different and they're tested for a little differently. And academia has a nice way of chopping things up into finer and finer gradients in order to make a small mark in a crowded field. Right. And so I tried to avoid that and really zoom out and say, okay, what are the big unifying issues here? And how do they tie back to how your brain works and how your brain developed over time? And so the three issues that I found that unified kind of almost all of these concepts, not all of them, but the vast majority, is what I call the, you know, the three S's: self-esteem, stories, and snap judgment. So, you know, humans are very focused on self-esteem, you know, as a way of, I guess, motivating themselves and feeling good about their role in whatever society they exist in, et cetera. And so they're willing to lie to themselves in order to preserve that sense of self-esteem. Stories are narratives, as we discussed. Humans just think in terms of stories. That's how we've communicated, you know, the oral tradition of history or going even further back, like there's writing is a relatively recent development. And so we use stories, and stories are very powerful. And if you tell someone a story, they are likely to believe it, even if it's totally false. And then the third is snap judgments. And this goes to the kind of the type 1, type 2 brain division that Kahneman really popularized, which is type one is kind of that more primal basic brain, more of an instinctual, responsive, make sure that you don't get eaten by the saber-toothed cat type part of the brain. And then type two is, I think, what most of us would think of as more of the human brain, which is the more deliberative, rational, and, you know, kind of deeper thinking brain. But type one always kicks in first. Type one's the fast acting brain. And so the first thing that's going to happen if you see someone or hear something is your type one brain is going to form an opinion, or initiate a response to that. And most of the time it's fine, right? But a lot of time it's not. And so that snap judgment, that kind of instinctive response from the type one brain is what humans tend to gravitate towards. But what should be, humans should be very careful about, very wary of. So kind of grouping these cognitive biases into these three S's, again, self-esteem, stories, and snap judgments, and then just keeping those three S's in mind as, you know, kind of pitfalls you're likely to encounter, as opposed to memorizing, you know, hundreds of different, you know, very subtly different cognitive biases, I thought was a useful simplification.
I like that. And speaking about the last S there, the snap judgment, in the book you write that many of the recommendations in the book are based on replacing fast decisions with slow insights. I mean, this was just what you mentioned. And I think for me as a fundamental long-term investor, this really resonates, but there's sometimes the need for being a bit faster and taking swift action. And it's better to be roughly right than precisely wrong is a common expression as well. So we're curious what your thoughts are on this in the investing sense.
I agree that is better to be roughly right than precisely wrong. I guess I would argue it's better to be precisely right most of the time and then roughly right when you can't be precisely right. I think that's kind of the, in a way, like, I don't think it conflicts with what I've written in the book. In fact, I think it reinforces it, which is all of these concepts and all these frameworks are going to help avoid being wrong, right? Avoid making the wrong decision because you've taken some mental shortcut or you've had some, snap reaction to something that's not appropriate. I guess I think they're saying, you know, the messages are similar, or at least reinforcing, if not similar. The more you think about something, the more you have a process for making decision or interpreting information, the more likely that over time you will be more right than wrong. And again, investing, like many other things in the world we live in, is a probabilistic process, right? You're going to be wrong some chunk of the time. And you may have made the best decision in the world with the best information available and still lose money in investing, for instance. And so, again, it's much more about having a process that is solid and repeatable and fundamentally tested than it is about always being right, right? So, again, I'd say being right versus being wrong. Maybe the right, you know, again, the idea is to be right on the decision, not necessarily right on the outcome.
And I mean, part one of the book is about all these 32 mental models. And I mean, it's clear that we discuss biases and one bias is that we always search for a reason, a why, and why learn about all these 32 mental models. And that's what you answer in part two, with sort of it leads you to become a better decision maker, a better learner, get more happiness out of life. Can you talk a bit about how you thought about constructing part two, and if it comes from your own experience and so on?
Yeah, I think the five frameworks that I talk about in part two are learning, deciding, understanding, investing, and happiness. And I think that, you know, the frameworks were chosen for a few reasons. One, that the mental models and the concepts that I discussed in part one of the book, I thought were kind of lent themselves to improving oneself in these five specific areas. And then, you know, the other part is, what do I, you know, if I could get better at different areas of my life, what would I want to focus on, right? And so I think a lot of mental models, you might just say, are really about understanding, right? And maybe about deciding, you know, kind of taking information in, interpreting it correctly, and spitting out an appropriate response to that information. And so I added investing because that's what I know, that's my world. I added happiness because I do think happiness is important. I do think these concepts actually lend themselves to people being able to improve their happiness. And I think, you know, it used to be that the most popular class at Yale was a class taught on happiness by a professor named Laurie Santos, who was actually my class in college. And it used a lot of these concepts too, you know. And so I think, you know, there's something there that you know, people kind of assume happiness is coming from one area, and it's not coming from, you know, where they think it is. You know, I think, again, now it's a little bit more understood that, you know, material possessions won't bring you happiness, but experiences will. And, you know, a community and a sense of connection with people will bring you happiness, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's more of that out there. But again, there's no framework that most people can think of and say, okay, I'm unhappy. I'm not quite sure why I'm unhappy. How can I try to be happier? How can I think about things, the different aspects of my life in a way that will ultimately lead to my being happier. And so that I put in there just because I thought it was important. And then learning, you know, I think, you know, I'm a teacher. My parents are both teachers. I think it's just a really interesting question about how we learn, you know, what the pedagogy is today versus what it was when we were growing up, you know, what it is in Sweden versus what it is in New York versus what it is in China or somewhere else. And I think the, you know, the main, I guess, lesson that I wanted to put out there on the learning side, and again, I think some people will say, well, of course, that makes total sense. And some other people say, you know, I never thought about that, which is the way that people learn is highly variable. And the way that people learn different types of material should be really different, right? Like, you don't, kind of making flashcards or rereading material or underlining or highlighting or however people learned or were told to learn 30 years ago when I was in school is very different than what it can be today. And the type of material you're learning can, you know, should really demand a different approach to learning. And so all these areas were kind of areas of interest to me, areas I thought were important, and areas that I thought I could add something to by bringing this framework of mental models into.
And talking a bit more on the investing framework, I think it's interesting that from my perspective, it seems that you use sort of the mental model of inversion to more or less state what to avoid as an investor, to sort of, and not really about, I mean, swing for the fences and think about this to become sort of to become the best investor in the world. It's more or less how to get steady good returns for the long term. And I think that was interesting because, I mean, you have a background being an active investor yourself. So it's a bit similar to Buffett, I think, in terms of he recommends people to buy index funds and to steadily invest. Is there anything right of in my view of that, or how did you think about creating that chapter?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and I'll come to the index funds and ETFs in a second, but you know, more broadly, look, I think if you're a professional investor, you statistically do worse than buying an index fund. Right, again, look over the, you know, the reams of data that show that actively managed mutual funds destroy value. Look at the reams of data that show that hedge funds underperform you know, a 60-40 index. Look at all of this data. It's very difficult to come away with any conclusion other than, hey, the modern financial industry exists to extract fees. And if it can do that by adding value, great. If it can do that without adding value, that's also fine. And it's very difficult for the average investor to perceive what is real value and what's not. And I think you can kind of go through, I don't even want to, you know, kind of catalog the amount of wrongdoing by many, many people in the industry, across, you know, from kind of money managers, you know, RIAs all the way up to people who run the biggest firms in the world. So, look, I think the reality is we live in an incredibly efficient market. If there's any informational edge, it's gained by spending many, many millions, tens of millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars at this point. And everyone else is in the casino. And we go into the casino, you are statistically going to lose. You may win once in a while, but you are going to statistically lose because there are just too many people extracting fees from you at every point, right? And so if you know that the average active manager is going to underperform the index, and if you know that in theory, these are professionals who are dedicating their lives to doing a good job. I don't think they're not trying to win. I think they are, but they are statistically losing every year. And it's just not possible for them to win when middlemen are capturing the fees they're capturing, and the quants are capturing the spread they're capturing, and hedge funds are spending $1 billion a year on satellite data and bespoke $1 million research projects, et cetera. So I think the best decision for an amateur, for a non-professional investor, is to choose not to play. Again, inverting the situation, if you know you're going to lose if you play the game, what's your best strategy? Your strategy is not to play the game, right? And so you get to ETFs at that point. I think it's the natural state of affairs. The problem with ETFs is that ETFs are designed for their customers, and the customers are not individual investors. The customers are the investment banks and the traders who exist to trade these ETFs and to create and collapse these ETFs to keep the arbitrage intact. And so if you're creating an ETF where your customers are the investment banks and not the end users of the ETFs, you're going to design those ETFs differently. And you're going to design these ETFs to have, you know, kind of a weird addition and deletion mechanism where it automatically kind of costs the ETF money, right? It automatically causes the index to underperform the average stock. You're going to have a weird sizing methodology where, again, like if you had a portfolio of 500 stocks, you would not have that portfolio be, you know, have 10 stocks be 50% of the portfolio, and then another 50 stocks be, you know, another 25% of the portfolio, and then 400, you know, 1 basis point positions, right? That's not how anyone would construct a portfolio. And yet that's how the most popular ETF in the world constructs its portfolio. Why? Because that makes it easier to trade, not because it's the right thing to do. Happens to have worked okay in the last 5 years because the mega caps have outperformed. But over a cycle and over time, buying high and selling low is a bad strategy. So I think you can add all these things up and say, you know what, there's no need to index. Most people have zero cost trading accounts and they can self-index. They can basically synthetically index and just buy 50 random names. And I say random because, again, the information is pretty good out there. And therefore, it doesn't really matter if you buy industrial A or industrial B. The market's statistically going to have priced them more or less equivalently. And efficiently. And so people can effectively create their own ETFs without paying for the cost of the ETF that are structured not to benefit them, but are benefit the financial intermediaries. And then that also leads to some tax efficiency, right? Where you can realize short-term losses if you have a portfolio of 50 names that you can't do if you step one ETF.
Okay, so going in a bit to your experience within the investment world, which is obviously something that you're really knowledgeable about, which can be seen with your answer there. I mean, you've worked at several renowned firms, and I'm curious if you could tell us about your experience working at Greenlight Capital with David Einhorn.
Yeah, you know, so David is a dyed-in-the-wool value investor, and value has had a tough run. Not just, you know, not just David, but a lot of value investors have found, you know, value is under growth for a while. So I'd say, you know, from press reports, it seems like they've evolved their investment approach a bit, and it seems to be working a bit better, which is great. When I was there, I think it was more of a question of, hey, in a world where securities are expensive and you can't find a, you know, stocks that are cheap enough to kind of meet the valuation hurdle, do you change about your valuation hurdle, or do you opt to stick with it and kind of accept lower quality businesses as a result? And I think, look, in general, any investing philosophy needs to have this process of saying, okay, what in our investing approach should stay the same and what should evolve? What's important to leave untouched and what is really kind of not reasonable anymore? And I think it's just a great question to ask, I mean, more broadly than investing, but certainly for investing. And so I think maybe that's happened a little bit since I left there, based on what I read again. But look, I really enjoyed my time there, and, you know, it was a very talented group of investors who was really enjoyable to work with. I do regret I never got to become head of macro, but maybe in the future.
Was there anything, was there any skill that you learned that you, I mean, of course you learned a lot, but is there anything that stands out in terms of how you have thought about investments since?
I think that the fundamental approach that they took, or that they take, I guess, really is just hard work, smart people, and try to be intellectually honest. And I think that's the right approach, right? And so I wouldn't say that was new, but I think it is a I think it's important to realize that's kind of the, you know, however you implement your investment strategy, if you have those three aspects and you put them out there in a, you know, and kind of put your best foot forward, over time it should work out for you. And I think that is, you know, that's there, true there as it is a lot of other places.
And after Greenlight Capital, you joined Serrano Capital, backed by another legendary investor, Dan Loeb. And the hedge fund closed its doors after only around a year. Are there any lessons you would like to share about that experience?
Yeah, you know, there is an anecdote in the book that kind of refers to that. I won't tell you which one. Maybe you can pick it up. But the experience, I would say, was a good one. I think that the lessons, to some extent, are that you need to have a motivated, kind of have everyone's motivations on the same level, right? And so, we launched. The expectation was that it was going to be a big launch, and there would be $1 billion of capital coming in the door on day one. The fund was sized for that. The infrastructure was sized for that. The money didn't come in, and I think a lot of it was on the sidelines, kind of waiting to see how the returns were. And so, the fund was run for a year, and the returns were fine. They were positive. I think mid single digits, something like that. They weren't exceptional. And, you know, the senior partner, for better or for worse, decided that this was not a struggle he wanted to engage in. You know, he kind of was like of the mindset that, you cut your losses if things don't turn out as you hope. And, you know, it was a difficult fundraising environment. It was no one's fault. It was just not meant to be. And with the shot, didn't work out. And again, it goes back to, well, was this the right decision? I think it was still the right decision. Not all good decisions have good outcomes. And there's definitely some luck tied to it. But yeah, the hedge funds and partnerships in general are inherently risky. Endeavors, you know, and so I can't put them all.
And how are you allocating your time these days?
So I teach a class up at Columbia Business School. I write research for investment funds. I've taken up Irish fiddling, so that's a new hobby. I call myself semi-retired, so I kind of work. More when I'm teaching, but maybe 30 hours a week on the investing side of things, and then I have time for some other aspects of my life.
And which class is it at Columbia?
So it's a class on short selling, and the idea behind the class is to maybe dispel some of the negative perceived attributes of short selling and kind of reinforce the importance of short selling as a mechanism for keeping orderly and efficient markets. And I think, you know, one of the lessons I try to teach the students is that short selling has been around since the advent of public markets 400 years ago, Dutch East India Company, and there's a reason that regulators have kept it around. It's not a coincidence, because it leads to better pricing. A lot of, for instance, options markets wouldn't be nearly as efficient without the ability to be for short selling. And then it's really more about short selling as a process and as a way to, again, going back to inversion, avoid the negative. You know, find the businesses that appear to be good businesses, appear to be good stocks, and apply a more cynical approach to them. So, you know, the vast majority of the students, and we have probably 100 students a year, will never short sell a stock in their life. You know, the vast majority are going to go into long investing and hopefully take this tool set avoiding potential landmines and use it to become better investors overall.
And can you talk a bit about how you invest your own money today?
So I have a synthetic index, you know, investment. I have a few investments in friends funds, people who I believe are hardworking and adding in an aspect of investing that I'm not able to do. So it might be like a biotech fund or a frontier market fund, something like that. And otherwise I have a portfolio that I have single names in that I invest in, both long and short. And then I have, frankly, a lot of cash and a lot of fixed income or fixed income equivalents. So it's a very risk averse portfolio.
And in the book, you have the 32 concepts, but we're curious when it comes to your own investing, which is the most dangerous bias that you have struggled the most with.
Yeah, look, I think the commitment bias and this idea that self-esteem is such an important part of the human experience. It's very difficult to admit when you're wrong. I mean, just ask my wife, she'll confirm it's very difficult for me to admit that I'm wrong. And I think that's true in investing also, and there's a risk of thesis creep. There's a risk of, okay, I'm not right yet, but I will be right. And in investing, again, you have to be intellectually honest. You have to remember it's probabilistic. You don't need to be right every time. And it doesn't imply that you're a bad person or that you're a dumb person or that your investing process is flawed if you lose money. It's much more important not to lose a lot of money when you're wrong than it is to not be wrong.
I think from reading your book and from this conversation and also you saying you're semi-retired, it's clear that you value other things than money and status in life. And we're curious if there was like a special time or a moment where you realized this. We can consider that you had many roles where you worked a lot in the hedge fund industry.
Yeah, I think I've always realize this a little bit, which is maybe why, you know, a lot of my friends are wealthier than I am. But look, at the end of the day, my parents were both teachers. They always had time to spend with us growing up. We always had dinner together as a family. They always took the, you know, put an emphasis on appreciating the cultural offerings of New York City. I grew up in New York City. And, you know, going to museums or going to plays or going to concerts. And so, you know, I think I've always had a lot of interests throughout my academic and personal career. I've always had artistic pursuits. I've always had athletic pursuits. I've always had intellectual pursuits. I've always been able to, you know, satisfy those to some extent. But I think, you know, there's only so many hours in the day, right? And so when you're younger and you're working 8 hours a week, that means you're not going to do certain things. And then you have kids, and, you know, I had started my own fund at that point. So when you're on your boss and you have employees and you have young kids, there's not much time to do other things at that point either. But when you reach a certain point in your life, there are a lot of these latent interests that have been sitting there and kind of simmering. And when you have a little more time, you can feed those interests a little bit more effectively. But I do think it's important to have a well-balanced set of interests and keeps you interested, keeps you motivated, keeps you off the couch watching Netflix or YouTube or whatever it is that ultimately is not going to work out for people if they do too much of it.
Yeah, it really seems like there are these different phases in life, and everyone takes their different turns. But I liked what you wrote in the last chapter on happiness there, that we are notoriously bad at predicting our own intellectual and emotional evolutions. This internal growth. I mean, we can think today that we are, like, in the future, that is my goal, that's what I want. But then you don't know if that's how you're gonna feel if you reach that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you know, I think, you know, it's related to the happiness question, right? Which is, even if you know, or you think you know how I think that this maybe wasn't in the context of, okay, how do you choose a profession, right? So if you know for sure that medicine today will look, or that medicine in 30 years will look like medicine today. So you knew that, which you don't and you can't, but say you did, or law or investing or any of these industries that a lot of people start down the career path and then realize that it's changed quite a bit by the time they get to it, where they think they're going. Even if that is true though, you don't know what you're gonna be like at the end of that path, right? And you don't know if you're gonna, you know, you thought you'd like this, but turns out you're a different person now than you were when you made that first decision. So I think it's important to be flexible. It's important to lay the groundwork for a variety of different outcomes, and that if something doesn't happen as you hoped it would or thought it would, or if you're a different person, you know, by the time it does happen, that you can pivot and you can do something else with your time, do something else with your life, and have a skill set that can be applicable to a broader set of endeavors than just, you know, one specific path that you think, yeah, is the right path for you, but you may not be right.
So knowing what you know now, would you have embarked on the same journey when you got into the hedge fund industry today?
You know, I'm a very lucky guy. I have no complaints. My mom still wants me to be a doctor. as my brother said it as part of his wedding toast, Kathleen, my wife, is the daughter and the doctor that mom always wanted Jamie to be. So, look, I think I married a doctor instead of becoming a doctor. Would have been an interesting path for me. I think I would have enjoyed it. But again, that the true privilege, I think, of the investing world is the idea too that you can exist in a world where you can learn new things every day. I think that's really a privilege. And that, you know, the flip side of the investing world, as you may have picked up by some of my prior comments, is I'm not convinced the investing world does that much good for the world at large. You know, I'm not sure that investors broadly are giving as much as they're taking. And that concerns me. And I think, you know, part of short selling, you know, people who do short sell, and again, there's a lot of criticism for short sellers, but I do think that the average short seller is taking a harder path because they do believe that they're ultimately going to improve the world in which they exist. And the world they exist is the world of financial securities and the world of, you know, fraudulent or semi-fraudulent promoters trying to take money from, you know, mom and pop who don't really understand what's going on. And I think short sellers, at least partially, are motivated by the desire to work against that and to find some, you know, some meaning in the broader investing process. So, look, I think looking back, what would I have changed? Again, I'm a very lucky guy, and I've got to learn new things every day of my life, and I have a, I think, you know, pretty good work-life balance. I'm sure there are some decisions that could be made a little differently over the time, but, you know, I hadn't written the book yet, so next time around, I'll have that in my back pocket.
And is there something else that you think investors could do to improve society and the world, as you mentioned?
Yeah, look, I think there are, I think the starting point for a lot of investors is to realize that, hey, you're very lucky. You know, like Warren Buffett, I heard him speak once, and he said, and I'm sure he said this multiple places, but he said, look, if I had been born in a different time, in a different place, I would have been lion food. You know, I can't see that well, I can't run that fast. I happen to be born, you know, if I'd been born in Bangladesh instead of the US, I would not be Warren Buffett. I'd just be someone else, right? And I think there's a lot of luck, and there's a lot of, hey, you happen to be, you know, especially US-based investors, you happen to have been born into the greatest bull market in the history of all financial markets. When interest rates dropped from, you know, 15% to zero on their way back up to 4%, and in a world where, you know, the rest of the global financial markets have had a bunch of their own issues and capital has flowed to the US. And so, you know, we live in a world where being long US stocks has been a very nice tailwind. And, you know, confusing skill for luck is always a tricky thing. So I guess I would say is humility is important. And there are a lot of people who've made a lot of money investing, and it's not because they're the smartest people in the world. It's because they were in the right place at the right time. And broader society has not been as lucky. You know, that the average person in this country, the average person in this world, is not feeling as good as people who own NVIDIA. And just be a little bit more aware of that. So, look, I think there are a lot of wonderful charities and a lot of organizations started by people in the investment world who understand, you know, that aspect of their existence and that responsibility to society. I think Robinhood's, which fights poverty in New York City, is a great, great organization. I think there are a lot of other great organizations, and I think more of that, the better. You know, kind of just understanding the, being paid, most people are paid on beta, not alpha. And if they were all paid on alpha, then the world would be a very different place. And the distribution of income and wealth would be meaningfully different from where it is today.
Great. And as this is a book podcast, we like to wrap up with questions about reading and writing. Besides your book, do you have any other books or resources that you would like to recommend to our listeners to dig deeper into?
On the book side, I really like Morgan Housel's Sane as Ever, which is, again, another book on mental models. But just really, really nicely written. I think just some really nice anecdotes and narratives. You know, as I was saying, narratives are always pleasant. So I think that's a good one. On more broader nonfiction, I think the recent Martin Luther King biography is really outstanding. Really kind of takes you into, gives you an understanding of who he was as a man. And, you know, kind of the challenges he faced, just like everyone faces challenges, and how he, you know, how he handled those and overcame them and kind of did what he did. I was just, again, really well researched, really well written. And then for fiction, there's a recent one I read called Creation Lake, which is just really, a great story, beautifully written, that I would highly recommend.
Thank you for those recommendations. We will put them in the show notes. So do you have any other writing projects going forward?
I'm thinking about it right now. Nothing concrete.
We'll keep our eyes open for that. Jamie Lester, thank you so much for coming on Investing by the Books podcast to talk about you and your book, Pause to Think. Do you have something more here that you want to add before we finish up?
No, just thanks for having me on, and thanks for listening, and good luck with everything.
Great. And lastly, where can our audience follow you and your work and buy the book?
The book is on, you can get from Columbia University Press directly, or it's on Amazon. I don't have a real social media presence. I'm kind of a little bit ethically torn about what to do about that. But for now, I'm just kind of sitting on the sidelines. So yeah, buy the book.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. Follow us on Twitter at @IB_Redeye and email us at ib.podcast@redeye.se. To improve, we'd love to hear your feedback, so please rate and review us. Notice that the content in this podcast is not and shall not be construed as investment advice. This information is meant to be informative and for general purposes only. For full disclaimer, visit redeye.se. I'm your host, Eddie Palmian, and until next time, I sincerely wish you the best of luck on your journey through life and investing.